Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast, where we explore cutting-edge strategies to keep teams human-centered, drive innovation, and empower you with the tools and insights needed to help your team excel and thrive in today's rapidly changing world. Your host is Dane Grunewald, a seasoned expert with over 20 years of experience enhancing team dynamics and innovation. Today, Dane is joined by Scott Gottesman, a results-oriented HR leader with more than 20 years of experience in over 25 countries, including living internationally in the biopharma industry. Scott has a deep understanding of the complexities of human capital management and a proven track record in driving organizational growth and success. Here's what you'll gain from their conversation. First, recognizing potential in others. Scott emphasizes the power of a leader who sees untapped potential in someone, turning that belief into an opportunity for growth. He shares how one person's vision can redefine someone's career path and open doors. Second, building understanding in teams. Scott underscores the value of seeking to understand each other's unique perspectives, especially within global teams. This approach fosters trust and collaboration across diverse cultural backgrounds. Finally, making meetings matter. Scott offers insights into making meetings intentional and impactful, not just another item on the calendar. By respecting others' time and setting clear purposes, meetings become a platform for true progress. So, teamwork makes the dream work, and we're here to inspire your next collaborative breakthrough. Gather your team or put on your headphones, and let's dive in together.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name's Dane Grunewald, CEO of the Huddle 3 Group, and today I'm joined by Scott Gottesman out of Boston. Scott is a Celtics fan. We've had a good conversation about tequila and electronic dance music too. But all of that aside, he's a strategic, results-oriented HR leader, a lot of experience in the biotech space, which is fascinating for any of our listeners out there that know just what achievements that these biotech companies make from early and humble beginnings. So I'm excited to dive into Scott's experience in really building these inclusive performance teams across some pretty cool science. So welcome, Scott.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Dane. It's great to see you again.
Yeah, you too. Maybe for the benefit of our guests, I got to meet you in Boston, but maybe you can tell them a little bit more about your backstory and how you came to be doing all this cool work.
Yeah, absolutely. So first off, you're right. I'm a bit of a Celtics fanatic. Growing up, I actually grew up in upstate New York, but I was able to watch some of the Celtics games. I was on the eastern side of the state, so I was a big Celtics fan. And then when I moved here, continued that, and was very lucky at the time to actually be at the Garden to watch the Celtics win awesome. their championship a bunch of years ago. But I wasn't able to go see the recent one. So I'm a huge Celtics fan. And as you shared, I'm a big music guy, started my career actually in the music business before transitioning into HR. So yeah, I'll share a little bit about myself and then we can go from there, Dane. Sound good?
Sounds great.
Yeah. So, early on, I had a deep passion, for music. And in high school, I met a friend who actually was a DJ and he had, turntables at school and I was fascinated by his records and him DJing. So my junior year in high school, I decided to get into it myself. So my junior year in high school, I started buying records and we were mail ordering records and getting records. And that was my start of kind of getting into electronic music as well as DJing. And that passion continues today where I still produce and make music. But, when I went to college, my passion for music was very much still there. And as the electronic music scene was really evolving, kind of in the early and mid 90s, there was a business opportunity that I saw, with my friend and then also, a farmer who was in the UK at the time. So the records we were interested in were highly limited, right? We're talking about one of 1,000, maybe 2,000 runs in the world. So not very many, hard to get, right? So we said, gee, if we had access and we could distribute these and, get a big chunk of them, maybe there's a business here. So in college, I wanted to kind of leave college early and start this record import business kind of continue my DJ life and career. So I stayed in college. I graduated from Brandeis University here locally in Massachusetts. And then very quickly, was trying to set up a small business where I could import records from the UK, these highly collectible vinyl imports, and then distribute them to like businesses. And, we had a a friend of a friend who became my partner that was on the ground in the UK, so we had access to these imports and could hopefully, you know, get them before they distributed to other places. So, you know, we were the destination to find these limited records. Nice. So in April of 1996, I started a retail store on Newbury Street in Boston, highly kind of prestigious, you know, street in Boston, very cool cultural melting pot of people here in Boston, a really historic street. And it was really exciting to be there. So at 21, at that time, I was the youngest sole owner of a business on Newbury Street. We, you know, ultimately ran that for many years. And then, you know, I moved at one point to another place in Boston before ultimately closing my business due to technology mostly. Unfortunately, you know, as you know, the everything became digital with file sharing. But the biggest hit, honestly, for, you know, which changed the world and which you see today was the digital turntable, right? So originally, you probably the traditional turntables were vinyl. Well, now they're all digital turntables. And as Pioneer invented really the first adopted version of that, that really shifted the DJ market to today, where that's the standard of what people use. So ultimately, I say, always joke, technology kind of put me out of business. But during that time, you know, I ran the business. I DJed actually all over the U.S. I DJed internationally. I hosted my own club night here in Boston, where I was a resident actually at two different nights in Boston. Really enjoyed the music electronic scene. And again, still have a passion for that. I make music today and still produce it, which is exciting. But, you know, when I closed the business, I had to kind of think about what next, right, Dane? I didn't have a traditional background. You know, I didn't have a corporate background and I didn't know what I was going to do, but I did know I'd have to reinvent myself at that point. So, you know, my wife, who I was dating at the time, said, hey, go meet a couple headhunters, right? So, Dan, I said, okay, trust her. I'll meet a couple headhunters, kind of share my background, think about what I wanted to do next. And I liked the BD side of the business I was in. So I was thinking maybe some type of sales, actually specifically pharmaceutical sales to transition into. And as I met with each of these firms, Dane, a funny thing came up. They all said, hey, you ever thought about what we did, right?
Yeah.
As recruiters. And I said, no, I never thought. I didn't know what it was. So I met a couple more. They all said the same thing, right, Dane? So at that point, I stepped back and really assessed, like, wow, wait a minute. Some people see value in my experience as a background and think I could be good at this. Maybe I should understand and explore it and see if it could be a pivot in my career or next step, right, for me of what I wanted to do next. And as I researched it more, it made sense for me, right?
Yeah.
So ultimately, I decided to move forward with this and started my kind of HR career on the agency side, you know, obviously, you know, more on developing relationships with talent in the market than ultimately with companies and hiring managers. And, you know, was a headhunter for 8 years at a very well-established, well-regarded 40-plus-year-old agency in the New England market. And, you know, but like many, after you've been in the agency for a while, I got the itch. What do you do next? And the next step is to go in-house, right? Work at a company and help build that from a talent acquisition standpoint. So that really, you know, was my next step where I got into big biotech. And I had this magnificent, you know, 8.5-year run in an incredible biotech company that led me through, you know, supporting and learning different parts of the commercial business, manufacturing business, even, you know, R&D, et cetera. And then also, as my career progressed in biotech, was really given a wonderful opportunity to grow from a global competency standpoint, where I was able to work in over 25 countries. I lived internationally and localized internationally, got to learn so much about so many different countries, about talent in those countries, cultural nuances and differences, you know, from a business standpoint. And then repatriated back to the U.S. in 2000 and, I'm losing track of time. I repatriated back in 2018 and then ultimately, you know, decided to kind of take my experiences and skills and get into a small biotech company that was very young to kind of combine my early entrepreneur spirit to help build a small biotech company. And ultimately, you know, where I've been the last 5 years, where, you know, my final role was obviously leading HR for that organization. And then more recently, successfully, we sold an asset to Big Pharma and then completed a merger, a reverse merger this summer And that kind of ended things, you know, for me at that point. So I'll pause there. You know, it's a wild journey of kind of my passions and then kind of falling into HR. But I will just say one final thing. When I look back over the years, and if I said to myself, like, wow, would you ever thought you'd get into HR when I was graduating from college? The answer would be no. And, you know, and even though that's the case, I fell into something because someone saw value in me that I absolutely love today. It was absolutely the right decision of others to say, this could work for you. And I wouldn't want to be doing anything else but working in HR today. And I love it. And it's been a great run so far over the last 20 years.
I love that, Scott. And it's pretty cool. Like you, I started my career on the talent acquisition side. And it's pretty cool when you have someone who spots that talent. I had a similar story. I met my first boss actually working in a bar in London. And he came and offered me the job. But when that person sees that value in you and brings you in and starts to show you something new, it creates a whole lot of pathways, as you've evidenced.
Yeah, and I'm a little biased to those with talent acquisition background and recruiting background. So but what I will share is I think that's really important for, you know, for successful HR leaders, right? Yeah. And I share that because I kind of joke with people, they're like, who makes really great, you know, heads of HR or HR leaders, right? And people say some things. And my joke is, well, the best HR leader is a mind reader, right? You know, someone who knows and can get in the minds and understand talent or people in your organization. And when you think of recruiters and people in talent acquisition, well, that's what we've done, right? We've spent years in the minds of talent, understanding what makes them tick, what drives them, what motivates them, what inspires them, who or what influences them to make business decisions. So I think that foundation, I think, is really helpful when we think about talent as a head of HR, you know, culture, organizational health, all of these things. I think, and I'm biased here for you and I, but I think it's a great foundation because we understand and really know kind of before talent knows what they're thinking, maybe what they're thinking.
Yeah, I think that's powerful. And I also, we've got a guest of the show, past guest of the show, Andre Martin. He wrote the book Wrong Fit, Right Fit. And he talks about not only the importance of recruiting talent into the business in the right way, but re-recruiting talent that's already in the business. So I think even beyond HR leadership in today's kind of modern workplace, particularly a lot of remote work or remote first workplaces, it's important that all leaders are constantly kind of scanning their talent and thinking, well, when someone ready for that jump, or what might someone not be enjoying, and how could we better, you know, channel their energies as a member of the team?
Yeah, I totally agree with that and love that, right? Just like in sales, always be, you know, always be closing and recruiting. You're always recruiting, and then you're always recruiting when your people are inside to retain them, right?
Yeah.
And especially in COVID, when we have the great reshuffling, it's like, how do you re-recruit your talent, right? To reinforce why they came there, why they should stay, and to go through some of the challenges of the market that we had, especially in the biotech space. But yeah, it's a great point.
That's cool. And biotech, you talked about it going global, managing people. I think you said 25 countries. There's a lot of nuance, the technology, the legislation and regulation, the cultural differences of people. How do you, as a leader of HR, how do you go about creating that connection across those teams?
Yeah, for me, it was new, right? So I had inherited a team with team members in multiple countries, right? In APAC, Europe, in LATAM, and in the US as well. So, you know, for me, you know, I got some advice that really kind of resonated with me. And it was this just simple thing, like, Scott, you have to seek to understand, right? Mm-hmm. You know, before you can support your teams, you've got to better understand their localized business, their customs, their nuances of culture that are different than just American, right? An American culture being broadcast as being a global company, and understand what they go through, right? So, you know, what I did was, you know, I asked a lot of questions, and I had to explain this because an American, you know, asking a lot of questions to international team members, they thought I was questioning them in some ways. Right. And this is part of really good communication. Some of the communication training and examples I give with teams and leaders is that sometimes it's misunderstood. Right. Communication is a process And within that, there's noise where it gets lost. So me asking a lot of questions came off as a little challenging. So I had to learn to say, hey, I'm seeking to understand. I ask a lot of questions because I want to learn. I want to really get context and framing of things so I can be a really great people leader or supporter of the business. That's how I process stuff and I can be effective. So one is seek to understand, Dave, right? I really spent a lot of time on trying to learn as much as I could and invest in my own knowledge, use my network, and people have probably shared this on your show before, use my network, talk to as many people outside of my industry and local countries. I developed a wonderful network of external partners where I would build that to learn, and they would love to share their knowledge. So I understood local partners or agencies, learned from them about recruiting dynamics, talent landscape, cultural nuances, statutory differences. So I spent a lot of time investing in learning before really I got into the role. Then when I was in it, even more time to understand that. And, then when I was in the role, Dane, when I started working with my dispersed teams, I felt like some of the one-on-ones we were having were just, they weren't very effective, I think, for my team members. I was accustomed to an American model of one-on-ones of going through things. So I started to ask some feedback from my teams, and something that helped me at that time, was really structuring my one-on-ones with remote international teams differently that were more beneficial for them than just me. Because it was one way, right? It was like, I needed these things being the head of all these regions and countries, and it was really one way. And I needed that to be more two-way communication for them to be bought in and to build kind of the trust, right, that's needed for a successful leader and their team members. So through some kind of discovery with the team, I changed my one-on-ones to a format that was, again, not groundbreaking, but effective, for remote teams. So one was, meeting for the month was really a working session where I just need to know things of their day to day. So we would go through positions or requisitions and HR stuff, and we'd walk through kind of their day to day, and we'd talk about that, right? Yeah. So another meeting that we had, was really, about kind of their growth and their development. We had very good discussions about what they're trying to grow in their career, and we set goals for that every year. So once a month, we would always talk about how are we tracking, are you doing these things, what can I do to help, and that would be their meeting, right?
Yeah.
Another meeting was literally their time. It's your format, whatever you want. If you want to cancel the meeting, take the time back, it's completely structured for you, right?
Cool.
And then the fourth one was really for me to share information, right? I think effective leaders have to really trust their teams. What I loved about moving into small biotech, I was shocked at the level of trust of information sharing. Big biotech, it's layered, and by the time gets down to you, it's kind of like, what is that? When the kids sit around and speak in the microphone like a monkey and the conversation's
telephone. Doing. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
No. Here, it's like blunt. Like, they share everything. I was like, wow, this level of trust, because they share all the information with their employees, was so refreshing. So for me, I had operated like that. I felt my teams were so disconnected from headquarters that I had to share everything that was going on there that I knew with them, right? To give them context of things that could really impact their job, their day-to-day, because they just felt so removed being in so many different countries. So that was just one meeting was, I'm going to share everything that I know, what's going on with the business and the regions, with HR, with TA, et cetera. And it was really just a sharing meeting of information about the organization.
That's fantastic. I love that structure that you've added to the one-to-one, because I've found at different times in my career that you're right, the one-to-one can turn into a get stuff done meeting. It's all about work, and you're not actually checking in on each other or having a moment to do real feedback or real planning. So by cycling through that carousel that you mentioned, so the working meeting, the personal growth meeting, the you make it your time, and then finally that information flow, that's a really healthy cadence.
Yeah, and it worked, right? And what I recommend to people is like, listen, that worked for me and what my team was, right? You need to decide. They might want something different, right? But the easy answer is, listen, have the conversation, right? Yeah. Ask the question and find out what's meaningful for your teams, because they are so, you know, when they're remote teams in different countries, they're fairly removed from what's going on at the headquarters or the global organization. And that worries them, right? That disconnect is uneasy to them. And you need to find a way to kind of disperse that or dissolve that out. And that takes effort.
I love that. I also like, Scott, the way you talked about leaning on partners in new countries. I think for anyone who hasn't gone and set up operations in a brand new location, it's pretty daunting. And so the ability to leverage those local partners is a great example of teaming up, and it's a great example of accelerating, you know, the work that is to be done.
You know, I'll share something funny, because, you know, my last few years, we were launching new businesses in new countries, you know, at the big biotech company I was working with. And the funny thing is, like, because of that model I had in place, we were able to get talent really fast, but we couldn't hire talent because putting together an affiliate or a country, the infrastructure required for them to be hired to and then be able to work in that environment.
Yeah.
Ready yet. Right. So that was a learning where I was disconnected from some broader business and HR things, that it's just not about going finding the people and then hiring them. You don't have the infrastructure, the system set up, you know, the contractual statutory things, like that is slower, right? And you have to be better aligned with your partners in HR, with finance, and legal, in launching new countries.
Yeah, that is interesting. And when you, let's say you get past all of that, so you've got the legal, the financial, you've got people onboarded. How do you coach leaders to manage teams in new locations? You know, that's a big shift when a business is scaling quickly, whether it's domestically or global. But like, where did you see some of the ways to drive a bit more team or organizational effectiveness from that moment of onboarding forwards?
Yeah, you know, again, I think it starts a lot with the leader themselves. And, you know, for me, you know, sometimes it's just putting the mirror up to them, like, you know, like, honestly, like, what type of people manager are you? And having that discussion, like, let's put the mirror up. Everyone thinks you're a great manager. You know, that's a skill. That's a competency, right? That is something that you have to work on and build that muscle. It's not simply, well, I've had great managers and I emulate what I've learned from them and I stay away from how I was treated with bad managers, right?
Yeah.
So I kind of like to, you know, in a collaborative way, put that mirror up to them and have a really healthy discussion, and then really understand where some of those gaps would be, and then start talking about some of the nuances that they should be working on if they want to be a successful people leader with global team members that aren't located with them, remote, you know, international employees. Some of it is starting right there and understanding how skilled they are as a people leader. And you know, what I found is that, you know, a lot of them just fell into it. And I was one of those people, right? I literally said, Scott, you're going to start managing, right? And, you know, I did the same thing. I thought about good managers and bad managers. And then I had some really good HR mentors who said, Scott, no, this is like working out. You've got to go out there and be purposeful, because, you know, the further and further you go up the ladder in any company, right, the less and less you're expert at anything, right?
Yes.
And your technical expertise becomes moot, right? Your people manager and leadership skills or leadership competencies are now what's going to make you successful and those around you successful. And, you know, without some mentorship and someone putting that mirror up to me, you know, and one being, you know, someone you work with now, right? I wouldn't have thought about that, because you know, I was a type A guy. I was more, you know, commercial mindset. I thought I knew. I could figure it out and just learn it. But no, it had to be purposeful. So I had that mirror put up to me, and I had to work on that.
That's neat. This concept of, and we talk about it a little bit with different guests, but as you move up in your career, that the expertise goes down and the importance of you being a team player and a team leader increases. There's certain chemistry that goes with that. It's really interesting. How much do you see in those cases that you're, as an HR leader, sitting down and coaching new leaders on a regular basis versus sending them to a traditional or conventional training program? Like, where do you see that sort of come to bear?
Yeah, I mean, a few things. I mean, you know, I think in young biotech, especially early biotech where I just came out of, you know, you have, well, first off, you know, before I get into that, let's just admit, and this is very common right now, our frontline managers are more stretched and stressed than they ever have been. Why? Yeah. Because especially in biotech, everyone's running lean because of the kind of external financial market and just, you know, kind of the economics of biotech. Everyone's stretched. So that means managers are player coaches, right? Yeah. Most managers, and I was like this for many years, right? I ran a desk and I had to manage a dispersed large team. That is very difficult. That can drive managers to a level of exhaustion that leads to, you know, burnout, right? You know, ambivalence, disengagement, and then attrition, right? They just can't handle it. And companies don't recognize that level of pressure, commitment, stress, right? And just intensity to run both desks, right? To run a people manager desk and you're doing the work. When you get into small biotech or early stage, everyone does that. Even your executive leaders, when you're a 30, 40 person company,
Everyone's rolling the sleeves up.
They're rolling up your sleeves and you have to manage, right? So one, you have to recognize what that job is. So our frontline managers and executives are, you know, have a dual role where they need to understand how to be effective at doing both. And sometimes doing both is a conflict, right? Because if you're trying to trust and empower your team, but you're the one also making decisions, how do you do that? Right. Yeah. And what I found is that was a big challenge sometimes in rapid growth young biotech. Right. We had new managers or stretch managers, new leaders who had never been at that leadership role. And their expertise was brilliant. I mean, just brilliant people. Right. But really struggled to navigate with, OK, as we mature, my role is going to look different. So when you think about an executive team in a 10 person company, they're involved in every decision. 20, 30 person company, they're involved in every decision anyway, right? But at some point, they're going to be like, okay, we're setting the direction with the board, right? It's like, here's what we have to achieve this year. And then you have to transition to say, let's go down to our experts that we built now, and they have to be the ones that tell us the options of how we're going to get there. And we're going to support them, eliminate the obstacles or barriers that won't allow them to do what they have to do to get us to where we're going. And the challenge is, it's not, you know, operationally, it's not that easy, right? I can say that, but it's hard for leaders to stop running their desk and do that, right? Because their knowledge is extensive. They're experts, right? So how do you transition into that and find ways to do that? That's, I think, where there's some sweet sauce that we have to work on in young, you know, fast growth biotech companies. But that's a big challenge. So, back to your question. So redirect me where you want to go now. I diverted just a little because I'm passionate.
No, I love it. And I think to your point, what I heard about the player coach role, as you described it, is that it's going to be new to them. Just giving people off the shelf training in that high growth environment is probably not going to be quick enough. And it's probably not going to be relevant enough to the context of the job. So there was a word that you were sort of circling and touching on, which is how. And that really captures my attention, because we've heard Simon Sinek talk about it's all about the why, right?
And, of course.
And I've got another good friend.
He's a fellow alum, by the way. So just to plug my university, but go ahead.
There you go. I've had another podcast guest, Dr. Ciroli, that talks about you actually need to start with the who's going to do the work before you get to the why. But what I'm hearing from you, Scott, is it's actually how are we going to do the work, and that will determine how we organize the team and manage the team and lift our leaders. And
I think you've hit on a key point. You know, when young rapid growth biotech, really understanding the work that has to be done, right?
Yeah.
Companies grow, like in lesson learned, you know, my last company, we grew. We were well-funded. We kept growing. We knew we were driving the business forward. But sometimes you got to slow down and understand, not just like, okay, here's the work that has to be done, but get into the weeds of that, right? Really understand tactically what exactly are we doing, right? Then you can better understand what type of workforce you really need to support that. And, you know, of course, some are more traditional models, but some are out-of-the-box models to support that work to get to a certain level, I would say, of inertia, of movement of the business, like a big tanker, right? As early stage, you're getting the tanker out to ocean. It's going to require some unique effort to get there. That workforce looks different. once you get some speed going, right, you're a big tanker at some point now, or some size tanker, you can release some of those early pushes and you have different work. It looks different, your workforce, and you have more of an agile workforce. But you're absolutely right. When I think about it, it all starts kind of from the hiring perspective, right? Mm-hmm. It is understanding the work and the right resource to support that work. And, you know, what I generally advise, you know, many leaders and hiring managers is you got to dig deeper, right? You can't just be like, great, I'm approved, my team is stretched, I'm going to go do it. Because yeah. when I sit down with hiring managers that have approved headcount, the first and second thing I'll say, Dane, is great. What are they going to do? Right? That's the project. How long is it going to take? Right? What are they going to do once that's done? Right?
Yes.
But the majority of the answers I get, I don't know what they're going to do next. So it's like, okay. So in 9 months, you don't know what they're doing next. So we need to think about what's the right resource then, right? Right? Because if you just bring someone on, you know, this might not be a good, well, first off, permanent headcount should be gold or platinum, right? You shouldn't invest yes. in a headcount unless you know it's continuous and the business need is there. You know, but once that person comes in, how are they going to feel in 9 months, you know, when all of a sudden you're like, well, the work has changed. I need you to do this now. And it's not involved or focused in their areas of passion or interests. What you're going to have is a retention issue, right?
Yeah.
But it's really understanding what is that work, right? And then defining the workforce from there.
I like that. It's interesting. It raises another question for me. You just said it, like the full-time headcount needs to be treated as kind of the gold standard. If you're going into a new country or you have a regulatory requirement to hurdle to overcome, particularly in biotech or life sciences, how do you as an HR leader coach and support executive leaders or senior leaders to look at that talent mix, whether it's an FTE, whether it's a contractor or a contingent worker that comes in, or whether you're actually outsourcing to a consultancy? Like, does that come into the HR sphere?
Yeah, I think that's where you become a true strategic talent advisor to your executives, and that's where you build your credibility, right? You know, It is understanding, if you really understand the business needs, the work that needs to be done, then it's presenting, here are your options, right? You know, I mean, obviously, if it's a sustained position with work that we know for the future, the answer to that is more simple. If it's not, and to your point, what's a fractional person? Is this better to outsource? Let's look at the financials on this. You know, how do you create that agile workforce when most businesses pivot and shift quickly, especially in younger biotech? And I always kind of joke, like when I think about any type of HR strategy, most people think a business is heading in one direction. It's very linear, like we're going from here to here, right? But the reality is businesses bend, they shift, they pivot, they change, right? So as an HR leader, you need to think of it more of as an arc, right? I'm creating this arc. No matter what direction we go, we're going to be okay, and we're going to have a workforce to support that, right? So one is understanding that and then presenting, here are the options with a, you know, business continuity, flexibility with a financial lens, right? You know, with a legal lens, right? Like, what are the legal commitments to do this? Because, you know, a lot of countries, it's, you know, you have some flexibility in some countries. We could do fixed term contracts. You know, you can hire people like that in the US. If you, you know, 1099 people, you know, and they're working with you and they're more embedded, you know, there could be co-employment risks, right? In other countries, there are none, right? You know, sometimes there are post, you know, co-ops or not co-ops, but you know, in some countries we found that postgraduates are looking for internships, and that's postgraduate, unlike the US. So you have a lot of mix of options. So to be a strategic partner, here are the different options and why, here are the financial legal implications, and then come up with a recommendation. Then you build real credibility, you know, with your leaders in those countries.
Yeah, I like that. And it becomes, I like your use of the word strategic advisor. It becomes more business consultant than what has traditionally been thought of as HR or people leadership, particularly when you've got that expansion going. That's really interesting. When you've seen teams come together, Scott, in new locations, whether they're FTEs or it's a hybrid workforce of consultants, contractors, what's surprised you in your career? Where have you like ran into a team and gone, oh my gosh, how did they achieve that? And like, how did you get curious, or what did you learn from those moments?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say that most cross-functional teams, even if they're all together or hybrid or all remote, right? none of them are, you know, operate, you know, at a high functioning level out of the gate, right? You know, that would be, you know, hitting a hole in one in golf, which I'm not a big golfer, but I've never seen anyone hit a hole in one. It's not going to happen, right? No. On TV, you know, but hey. But the reality is they're not built like that, right? So you have to think about from a fit for purpose standpoint, a cross-functional, you know, team, what are the dynamics to create a high-performing cross-functional team with all these inputs? So cross-functional being that in cross-geography. So let's say cross-functional, so different functions in the business. You know, if you think about a program team, let's say in small biotech, right? Let's say they're dispersed geographically and they're dispersed internationally, right? So now you need to see these dimensions of what the team looks like. And what you're trying to achieve, right, is, okay, this team has to execute really well, let's say, right? What they have to do is be able to, you know, come up, you know, it's not as much as developing a solution or creativity innovation. This cross-functional team is about getting stuff done. It's execution model, let's say, right? Okay, now I have the dimensions. I understand what they're trying to do. So then what are the core components of team dynamics or to create a high-performing team? Because, you know, a lot of it underneath that is highly engaged, right, and high-performing teams. So when we had some challenges, you know, in my last organization, it was defining that, like, what goes into the dynamics of a high-performing team? Mm-hmm. And I think that, like, you know, a lot of people, you know, there's different things. I mean, some of this is not like rocket science. But for us, we felt like because we'd come out of COVID, pretty much all of these people, it was mostly dispersed geographically and dispersed across multiple countries. We felt that trust and effective communication were the foundation for what we needed for execution mode for high-performing teams. Yes. So really, we thought about developing employees' competencies, you know, in a variety of ways with these micro-learnings and trainings and other kind of initiatives we did that were based on foundational communication, emotional intelligence, fostering effective feedback in the workplace, and kind of leading through informed trust and accountability. So for us, we said, okay, for these dimensions of teams, geographies, et cetera, where they are, these are the components we needed. And it started with some foundational communication. And that goes into just not how we communicate, but what means and why we communicate, right? So it's like, what medium is the right way for cross-functional teams to communicate, right? And that was a big one because we were, like many small companies, Dane, we were heavy meetings culture, right?
Yes.
Back to back to back to back, right? So again, in a small company, your managers and leaders are a player coach and they're in back-to-back meetings. How are they actually getting work done, right? Besides doing it all at night or on their own time and mm-hmm. basically getting to the point of exhaustion or burnout, right? I mean, that's kind of the challenge you're facing. You know, so, you know, how do you work through some of that? So for us, I mean, you know, there was, I think that some of it was started with fixing some of the meetings heavy culture that we had as an organization, right?
Yeah.
You know, and some of it was some meetings etiquette. And we see this over the years. This is not new, but it does start with like what I tried to explain, like if you're a meeting owner, you're controlling something that's so precious to from other people, which is their time, right? You're preventing them from doing their work, from their work-life balance, from being with their families, right? You were controlling their time because you set up a meeting. So I was trying to define like the responsibility of controlling someone's time is a really big responsibility. So you need to be thinking about what is the purpose of this? Do we have to have the meetings, right? You know, what, you know, within those meetings, how to make them really effective, right? If it's a decision-making meeting, what type of meeting it is, what we're going to get out of it, preparing people for those meetings, right? You own this. You're responsible, right? And it's your brand on the line. For those who run really good meetings, those are people that enhance those around them. People who run bad meetings, people remember that, right?
It drags everyone down.
It drags everyone down. So, you know, for me, that's another piece of this, right, for team dynamics was working through those team owners, you know, and those people running those meetings were also very important. So a few things to think about.
Oh, a lot, yeah. And so I hear the meetings piece around foundational communications, but what else fits into foundational communications? Is it getting into more the strategy, the objectives that we're trying to achieve each quarter, like OKRs, or is it behaviors? Like what else would you traditionally include there?
Yeah, I think with foundational communication, again, what I like about some of it is that communication is a process, right? There's a sender and a receiver, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes you just have to sit down, explain the process to these cross-functional teams in some ways, right? And then especially when you have remote teams and, you know, cross-geography teams, right? We had teams dispersed all over the country, some in Canada, UK, Australia, right? You know, before that, all over the world, right? So there are some cultural nuances that you need to address from a communication standpoint, right?
Yeah.
So some of it is really breaking down that process and understanding that really well, because what we found is that, and you probably agree with this, right? When things go wrong in communication, it's not purposeful. It's not like, oh, I don't like Dane, right? And if someone received it the wrong way, it's like, oh, Dane says, well, Scott's really aggressive and controlling in that meeting, right? You know, that could be the case, but I'm not doing it because I don't like you or I'm trying to shut you down. There's usually just some type of miscommunication, you know, or misunderstanding of the process of communication. And I give an example, Dane, like for me, you know, that I had to share in my career a little bit, right? You know, I got some feedback once in a meeting. Someone pulled me aside after, which is great. So plugging for feedback. And we get to that, how important that is for foundational communication, right? So if you don't get feedback, you know, you can't solve where some of this misunderstanding or noise, we would call it, comes in, right? So pulled me aside, said, hey, Scott, you know, wow, you were really fired up in that meeting. I mean, I was really passionate. Stuff, I get animated. I'm an East Coast guy. I'm passionate about the Celtics, my music, and what I do, right? I get excited. Yeah. And when I get excited, sometimes I get louder, right? And from all my music days, unfortunately, you know, I have tinnitus in my left ear, right? And I tried to protect my ears in production, and I had damaged hearing, right? So I don't realize at times I'm getting louder, right? And, you know, because I don't realize that and I'm passionate, I get louder. And that could be perceived in kind of the process of communication, right? That I'm upset, right? Or, you know, I'm being too aggressive, right? You know, I'm the American guy, right? But that's not where it's coming from, right? I'm not trying to do that. It's just I'm passionate and I don't hear well. So when I get into it, I speak louder. So I explain this to someone. They're like, wow, I didn't know that, Scott. That answers it. Great. You know, you should tell people this, right? You know, when you get to know people, you should set the foundation of communication about, like, here's some things to know about my communication style and who I am and talk through it. And then, you know, that person said to that person, hey, if you see it happening again, just let me know and I'll dial it back down, right? But again, that's an area where someone might be like, wow, he's coming across this way and I'm not doing because I don't like you or I'm being aggressive or something like that. I just don't know it's happening because of my communication, right? The way I communicate.
I like that. So it's like it's setting methods of communication, but also creating that responsibility across the team to, hey, watch out for each other's blind spots.
Yeah, and another blind spot simply is like, you know, we always thought it was very important, again, as a meeting owner, you have to have a clear agenda and prep material, right? Why is that? Because in a very scientific organization, and myself, which is surprising, we're a lot of introverts, right?
Yeah.
So that means I want to be prepared, right? So for me to be effective in a meeting, I need to have materials. I need to understand the agenda and I'll be ready to contribute and be effective in that meeting.
Yeah.
When we go off of that, I'm not a guy who thinks quickly on my feet sometimes, right? So like many introverts, I'm going to process this and I need more time before I can answer, right? So how does that show up in the process of communication? What shows up that person doesn't care. They're not involved in the meeting, right? You know, they're not participating because, you know, they didn't like the decision or whatever it was, right? That's how people might perceive that. But the reality is they just needed more time to process everything they heard than to come back and provide meaningful input, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to realize that happens often, you know, depending on the personality, beyond kind of the nationality or cultural or geography standpoint as well.
Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot. I can't believe we've already run through 40 minutes, Scott. There's been so much that we've covered, so much that I still plan to cover.
I just love talking with you because you're into this just like me.
So I'm pumped on it. And there's so many good points. I've got a couple of pages of notes here that we've touched on everything from, you know, how at the very beginning it's seeing value in someone and believing in them and bringing them along. I think that's great for all leaders to be doing in their teams, whether it's talent outside or within the organization. I thought it was cool the way that you led with curiosity and seeking to understand when you're working with global teams. I think more of us are working with global teams, whether it's day in, day out, or for discrete projects. And I liked this latter part that we touched on around, you know, foundational communications, good communication standards, particularly when there's cultural differences. So to your earlier point, you're not seen as being sort of loud and interrogating. You're seen to be really coming in there and engaging with teams. And that tied into that whole piece that we touched on around the how of the work, which in a fast-moving business is very important. We don't always know what work we're going to be doing in 9 or 12 months. So look at the how, look at the capabilities. Probably my biggest takeaway there was that meeting format that you had for the one-to-one though. And I think if there's one single thing that any leader takes away, it's being more intentional about that one-to-one and maybe changing up the meeting format each week or each bi-weekly period that you do it. Because I think that captures a lot of these topics that you've talked about today for building high-performing teams. So,
and one other, I add a point on that, Dane, right? One thing I've always shared, you know, with people managers is like the one-on-ones you have with your team members, you better not move those meetings.
Yeah.
That's the most important symbol of commitment to your team. Right? You've had this happen. My one-on-ones keep getting bumped. Something else is more important. I keep getting bumped. My meeting gets moved. Then I get an email. Hey, if you don't have anything this week, should we just cancel? Right? There's nothing more deflating, right, from an engagement standpoint than my manager not being fully committed to my one-on-ones, right? So I always found like, never do that. Like, you tell anyone else, unless this is a seriously business critical matter, like we got a legal issue, we got a lot, like you commit to your one-on-ones and you show up for them unless the other person can't do it. That's a commitment. You don't budge, right?
Yeah.
At all.
I'm a big believer in that. And I'm even seeing now, even in my own businesses, I'm starting to shift one-to-ones to Fridays intentionally because I'm like, it's Friday. We're getting into the end of the week. Let's reflect on what we've done this week. Let's plan for next week and let's not get caught in a fire drill. So I think anything that you can do based on the rhythms of your organization to honor that time is
and the person, right? Some person might say, I want to get ahead of my week with your perspective, Scott. Some might want the end. Right. Yeah. So you can have that discussion and tailor it. It's going to be more meaningful from a commitment. And the last thing I'll say about the one-on-ones, and you'll like this, like, you know, being intentional is so important because think about when you sit down with a one-on-one and you're with a manager and they're just like, so how's it going?
Yeah.
Right. And right. Right. And you feel the one you're pushing something to get out of that meeting. Right.
Yeah.
Again, that's deflating. I'm going to come out of that and that's going to drive me to a point of ambivalence, maybe disengagement, and then, you know, retention risk.
Yeah. That's what we should do. I think we should follow this show up and actually do a show on more cool format ideas for one-to-ones, job descriptions, you know, career planning, development plans, performance management. You know, there's so much in that space that I think everyone needs a bit of a reset on. So we'll definitely do that too. If any of our listeners heard something cool today or they want to just connect with you, where's the best place for them to find you, Scott?
Yeah, like most LinkedIn. It's funny, I got a message from LinkedIn that I think I was on my 18-year anniversary. So yeah. An early adopter. But you know, you can always reach out to me there, you know, reach out to connect. You know, the way I build my network has always been connect, share what I know, help people where I can, pay it forward from that standpoint. So if there's anything, you know, I can share, any perspective, anyone in my network I can introduce you to, especially in this job, this challenging job market for many job seekers, please take advantage of that. So I tell people you can reach out to me on LinkedIn, you know,
awesome.
And that's really easy. And I respond to everything. So I'm pretty good at follow up there.
Awesome. Well, thanks for your time today, Scott. I look forward to continuing this journey together as well.
Thank you, Dave. Great chat with you today.
Thank you for joining us. Remember that by embracing vulnerability, trusting our intuition, and approaching challenges with compassion, we not only strengthen our teams, but also pave the way for a future where collaboration thrives. If you're hungry for more insights, strategies, and research on collaboration, head over to thefutureofteamwork.com. There, you can join our mailing list to stay updated with the latest episodes and get access to exclusive content tailored to make your team thrive. Together, we can build the future of teamwork. Until next time,